In half an hour, Lord Coe will be explaining how he's applied the techniques that he learned as an athlete to his later careers as a politician and the leader of the London 2012 bid. Also around the midweek table will be the writer Seb Hunter, hat designer Piers Atkinson and the actor Sir John Standing. First on BBC Radio 4, the story of the man who invented natural history broadcasting and pioneered wildlife sound recording. Sean Street presents Ludwig Koch and the Music of Nature.
Listen to this. It doesn't sound like much, does it? But in fact, it's a sound document of great historical significance. The first recording of a bird. In fact, an Indian Sharma bird, made in 1889 by an 8-year-old boy from Frankfurt called Ludwig Koch.
I started with Edison cylinder, which my father gave to me.
Was ever a parent's gift more inspired? Because from that beginning grew the career of one of the world's pioneer sound recordists and natural history broadcasters, in his time at least as famous as David Attenborough today, a man who fastidiously but passionately recorded sound from almost the very first moment it became possible to do so, leaving a library of the music of nature in all its rich variation, and a legacy which endures today. To begin with, though, it was music in the conventional sense. The young Ludwig showed early talent and trained first as a violinist before becoming a singer, gaining access to an impressive circle of musicians and composers: Clara Schumann, Brahms, the great violinist Joachim, and Franz Liszt.
I was introduced of the oratorio of Franz Liszt, Christus Oratorio, and there the old Franz Liszt was coming. And I remember still this wonderful personality giving me a kiss and was very nice to me. This tall man, like a priest looking, like a Catholic priest.
But there was already another music surrounding Ludwig. From the age of 8, he would escape his violin practice at every opportunity and make for the local zoo until his mother actually locked him into the house to concentrate on his practice. In fact, his own home was a menagerie. 68 animals, birds, reptiles and monkeys. Little wonder that his recalled observation of Liszt showed the intense focus of a naturalist. As Hayden Lorimer, a cultural geographer from the University of Glasgow, suggests, the two disciplines were complementary.
Ludwig Koch was a man with a classically trained ear. He was gifted with a fine tenor voice and was actually part of the Wagnerian circle at Bayreuth, but illness prevented him from taking forward the singing career that he'd set out upon. And so he was someone who came at the recording of sound with a musical ear.
Nicht wer den Rat mir gab, ich musste auch hinunter mit meinem Wanderstab.
Recorded when he was 76, that was Ludwig Koch singing Schubert. But right from the beginning, there was an understanding in his mind of the sheer scope of sound and its capacity as a documentary tool, a witness to history. Where other children collected scribbled autographs of the famous, Ludwig collected sound autographs.
I even approached the world-known Bismarck, a very tall man, very big man, with a voice like falsetto. I never forget it. He laughed. He was roaring for laughter when I told him to say a few words. And he said in his high voice, "My son, don't forget my life. And don't drink so much as I did." And he was roaring laughter. Unfortunately, this phonograph cylinder disappeared. I never can get it back again.
And that note of regret there is significant. Koch was a Jew living in Germany in the 1930s.
I left Germany in January 1936 to lecture in Switzerland. I had my return flight given me by one of the big Nazis, a certain Mr. Göring, I don't know if you heard his name. And he was a very great fan of birds and animals, of my things. And after my last lecture in Switzerland, a man came to me, said, well, you don't know me, I'm the representative here in Switzerland of our government in Berlin, and I have followed up your lectures with great interest, and I've given a very good report. Mm. Well, I went to Zurich, and in the same morning, the headline was, Gustloff assassinated by the Jew Frankfurter. Gustloff was the same man who congratulated me. Knowing the mentality of Nazi Germany at this time, I thought it's not good to return. As they know now, I have been with this man a few hours before he was assassinated, and they just say I am involved in this thing, and telephoned to my Nazi director in the gramophone company, and told me, stay where you are, the air in Switzerland is much better for you than in Germany. Bullfinches were very gifted mimics of all kinds of tunes. There was a bullfinch in Berlin singing the communist song, The Red Flag. And when Hitler came into power in 1933, somebody denounced the owner of the bird. He was arrested and was released only after the poor bullfinch had been killed. You see, even mimicking birds have to suffer under dictatorship. Everything was lost. Very famous voices and very famous singers, all gone with the Nazis.
Koch's rehabilitation in Britain was due to the work of a number of key figures, among them the naturalists Julian Huxley and Max Nicholson. Within months of Koch's arrival in Britain in February 1936, he was busily at work with Nicholson on a major and revolutionary project, The Songs of Wild Birds, a commercial publication that combined text, pictures and recordings.
For the Songs of Wild Birds project, there was a specially kitted out sound truck which had Parlophone sign writing stenciled on its sides, so it was very obvious as it moved around. It weighed an incredible amount, such that it had to have a strengthened undercarriage and axle, and the weight came from the equipment inside. What was required was equipment which could heat up the wax discs for the recording to take place. The heating equipment was enormously heavy. The Parlophone van also had its dedicated driver, the wonderfully named Mr. Harry Hands. Several other members of staff would sit inside the recording unit, and other members of staff would be dotted around the habitat of the songbird, often reeling out long cables to take the microphone within reasonable proximity of the singing bird.
I have been trying to recapture the songs of English birds this spring. It has not been an easy job. You have first of all to watch your bird in its natural surroundings, sometimes for days on end, before arranging your apparatus. Then you set your microphone with a cable trailing through the woods and fields a mile or so away, and sit down and listen from 3 o'clock in the morning till after daybreak. That may sound simple enough, but wild birds, while they are not so well paid as some other wireless performers, are temperamental at all the same. And now here is the first record ever to be made of a green woodpecker. We took over a fortnight to get it.
It's really quite rare to find a complete, intact version of Songs of Wild Birds. The main problem is, of course, that the records are the things that get damaged first. I've been lucky enough to find an edition of it intact completely, and largely intact because it's still contained within its original packaging from Selfridges and Company of Oxford Street, addressed to a Miss Hughes of Northgate, Regent's Park. So if we take that off, we're confronted with this B beautiful, state-of-the-art Songs of Wild Birds, E.M. Nicholson and Ludwig Koch, published by H.F. and G. Weatherby Limited. It's hardly surprising that Koch had great problems finding a publisher for this, because it is effectively the first multimedia publication. And inside the box we have all the information you need to know. The first sound book of British birdsong tells of the unexplored world of birdsong, when, where and why birds sing, and how the songs can be recognised. Two gramophone records bring you from woods and gardens the songs of the nightingale, robin, blackbird, song thrush, chaffinch, cuckoo and other favourite birds. Text, sound, pictures. In other words, multimedia. And it all sold for 15 shillings. Well, this is the test. Let's see what these records sound like after more than 70 years. This is the nightingale. And even in that recording, we can hear that the sound of the bird is focused. There's no contextual background sound, no sense of the natural perspective. It's a specimen, in other words.
That's right. It's a paradoxical sort of authenticity, in that you need to isolate the songster, as he would have put it. He used the language of the stage very often in seeking to secure the very finest performance, a bird seeking to project its personality for an audience. And obviously background noise, which might interrupt or, if you like, obstruct the listener's appreciation of that song, was hugely problematic. And all sorts of different protocol for field recording were instituted by Koch, many of them quite complex and requiring a large backup staff, sometimes to flush out neighbouring birds from the habitat that the recording was taking place in, so that the sole songster could be secured.
This almost theatrical spotlighting of the sound is something that today's recordists continue to do, like Chris Watson recording here vultures and flies feasting on a dead zebra with a microphone placed inside the animal's carcass. Micro recording of intense detail.
In 1938, in Belgium, I had the privilege of making recordings of birds with the assistance of the Queen Elizabeth of the Belgians, the grandmother of King Baudouin. Every morning we heard the yellow icterine warbler singing, and as the Queen frequently called me by my Christian name, Ludwig, Ludwig, we all were roaring with laughter when we suddenly heard the icterine warbler calling my name during an interval in his singing.
I've come to the Science Museum in London. In particular, I've come to a storeroom in the Science Museum in London to look at equipment, and I feel quite humbled at this, because here I am recording this with a little over-the-shoulder recorder weighing a few pounds, and in front of me is Ludwig Koch's field recording kit. It's huge, it's made up of numerous units, the whole held together in a very sturdy case with Ludwig Koch written in big letters on it. It's a very impressive, clearly a very, very heavy piece of kit. With me is John Liffen, who's a curator of communications at the Science Museum. John, could you just talk us through it? Because what we have here are really a number of units spread out across two tables.
Well, yes, you've got the disc cutter over on the right-hand side, solidly built because, of course, it has to cut the groove sort of absolutely correctly. Next to it is a playback pickup arm and head, so that you can instantly play back what you've heard. Next to it is a sort of a control panel. The headphones are here, and various switches to operate the equipment. That's the main box. there's another wooden box to one side, and that contains the power unit. And you've got an amplifier unit, which the headphones and the microphone plug into over on one side. And then, of course, there's the loudspeaker, and there's another wooden box for the cables. And, of course, there's a great tangle of wires connecting everything together. So a substantial, chunky piece of apparatus.
And here we have the connectors that make all this work, and they look exactly like car jump leads.
They probably are car jump leads. Exactly what they are.
You couldn't really be spontaneous with this, could you? I mean, with the degree of time it must have taken to set up, it's not something you could just instantly record with.
No, it had to have been planned beforehand just to get the equipment there. And indeed, the equipment may well have gone ahead of Lefikoff by train, because there are still some railway company stickers plastered all over it.
There was something very moving about being confronted with Koch's recording equipment, the mechanics of his art, something that spoke of the tenacity of the man. Although it represented a vast improvement on the lorry he'd previously had to use, all that kit still required a huge act of will to get it to the wild places where he worked. A spectacular example of this was his recording of Atlantic grey seals on the island of Skoma, off the Pembrokeshire coast.
And then, from a remote rock in the Atlantic Ocean, the wind brought a ghost-like voice to my microphone. Singing of seals, and so the stories of sailors who have heard weird and eerie sounds came to life, and also the age-long stories of the mermaids singing on the rocks.
That recording haunted me as a child when I first heard it, and it wasn't only the sounds, the music of the seals, but the poetry of Koch's reflection and the sense of the man himself within that.
I think he regarded himself and indeed cultivated an identity of the impresario for nature's great performers and vocalists. He was a personality of radio, and there are fond memories of people's childhoods, of course, of listening to him either on the radio or having had records played, sometimes in schools and in village halls. I think that he wasn't always viewed necessarily as someone willing to share the limelight. Eric Sim, the naturalist and BBC broadcaster who filled Koch's boots, implied in his words that Koch was rather high-handed and self-important. I think that may have stemmed from Koch's awareness of his pioneering work and the status that had allowed him. But he wasn't universally appreciated, although I think by the common listener, he really was someone who introduced nature in an entirely different form.
The second one is representative of the Scottish mouth music, sung on the mouth. I experienced some difficulty with extraneous noise on this recording.
And when one has become as recognisable a personality as Koch was by this time, it's a tribute when the parodists step in. In this case, Peter Sellers.
The singer Hamish McPukes only gave off his best when singing on the corner of Socky Hall Street in Glasgow. You may hear some traffic noise. Pay no attention. Learn her to pay, learn and her to burn, lay and burn her, right on the way, me at the turn, for no for the way, for the
way. It's thought that Sellers based that on an actual recording of Koch's.
Street singer with spoons. The name of his tune is Les Gamins de Paris.
For me, though, Koch's original is beyond parody.
Yeah.
Koch's ability was centred on his inquisitive ear, the hunting down of wild sounds. So Atlantic grey seal or Parisian street singer, for him, they're just variants of the same thing, the performer.
The great novelty at that time was this remarkable man making recordings of birdsong in the wild. Nowadays, it's something we take for granted, but in those days, this, I could see, was the one great asset I had over the printed word, over the newspaper, over the book. I could actually let listeners hear the song of this bird or that bird, and this had never happened before. So this was a real landmark in radio.
Desmond Hawkins created the Naturalist programme largely as a vehicle for Koch's recordings, and this directly led to the formation of the BBC Natural History Unit in Bristol.
And when I was designing the programme, instead of having what was almost obligatory in those days, some piece of music which became your signature tune, I thought, no, I'd like to have the real sound of the wild. And I chose Koch's recording of the curlew. And I thought, that's our statement. We're going to take people as close to the wild as we can. We're going to make sure that they have the benefit of this new technique of recording wild sound, and we're going to stick to our masthead of science and observation.
Koch's achievement was thrown into sharp relief when we went to Elmley Marshes, an RSPB reserve on the Isle of Sheppey, to try to record our own curlew for this programme. We didn't have to transport van loads of equipment as he did, and the birds were there, although there were fewer of them. But getting close was the problem, and unlike Koch, we had just a few hours to get our recording. When we got to where we wanted to be, it wasn't only the curlews that gave us their voice. In the end, the limits of time, as well as planes, traffic, and the sounds of industry, were the challenges that defeated us. Ludwig Koch didn't only record in remote rural locations. I'm on the 7th floor balcony of Broadcasting House in London, looking down Regent Street. Here, Koch recorded the Black Redstart in May 1949, very nearly 60 years ago. Now listen, it's about 11 o'clock on a weekday morning in that selfsame location. Even given the time difference and lifestyle changes, how did he do it? It's easy, of course, to lament the past and dismiss changes as a sinking into noise pollution, but it's worth remembering that Ludwig Koch actually celebrated the sounds of the city in his own soundscapes.
I went to Paris to record everyday sounds, not the glamour of the cabaret and music hall. There is an atmosphere in sound which belongs only to Paris. The recordings which I made there for the sound picture come from all over the city, from les boulevards et les Champs-Élysées et les boulevards extérieurs. The cacophony of traffic.
It's a tradition that continues with Chris Watson. perhaps the greatest exponent of this form of work, which is a bioacoustic recording, and it's become a highly technical field and one which is subject to all sorts of different judgment, valuation and appreciation. Nature recording sounds are not now necessarily only understood as representative of species type. We also now have a world in which sound montages are produced or sonic journeys are recorded, such as to texture and colour up, if you like, a sound world of bird life and wildlife more generally. So I think that Koch's world and his work, for sure, are brought forward into the present.
Like the songs of wild birds in the 1930s, Chris Watson's composed soundscape of the Maasai Mara in Kenya is designed to be listened to, concentrated on, the music of nature. Ludwig Koch died in 1974 at the age of 93. He was still broadcasting when he was 90, and before that, recording in the most challenging of locations up to the age of 80.
The birds were silent, swimming always together. While I waited, I could see and hear whimbrels, golden plovers, arctic terns and snipes, and so on.
Today, the migrant birds he recorded in Britain as the spring turns to summer are diminishing at a frightening rate. A recent survey showed that since 1994, the wood warbler is down by 67%, the swift by 41%, and the beloved nightingale by 60%. But in Iceland, there are still around 3,000 pairs of great northern divers, loons, breeding where he recorded them on his last major expedition in 1953.
But I hate to concentrate on the great northern diver only.
As with a great number of his adventures, it was not the most comfortable of outings.
It was for the sake of that I have spent 5 days and nights alone on this wretched little island. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the two birds were swimming very quietly about 100 yards away, very often turning their necks towards me.
But like so many of the recordings over a lifetime of witness to the music of nature, it was eventually successful. And it was worth it.
Suddenly, I heard some very excited call notes from both the male and the female, even interspersed with these wonderful laughing notes. Listen.
Ludwig Koch's recording of loons laughing on an Icelandic lake. Ludwig Koch and the Music of Nature was presented by Sean Street and produced by Julian May.